Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's data log.
One is my name. The other is not.
2014, January 2nd. Just a little bit of feedback for your holiday podcast that you did. I don't think the Bajoran Gratitude Festival is actually called the Peldor Gratitude Festival. I think Peldor Joy is just something you say during the Gratitude Festival. The Klingon holiday for the Day of Honor was interesting because it appeared in one episode on television. It was a Voyager episode. But in novels, they did a whole series of novels where every novel line at the time had a Day of Honor novel. In the novels, we learn that the Day of Honor was actually a holiday that's celebrated based on something that Kirk did. Lovely. There's some event where some Klingons and Kirk teamed up together in an honorable way, and then they said, we're going to celebrate it from now on. So it's not this old, ancient holiday. It's actually this holiday that's only like 100 years old, and it was caused by Kirk. I didn't really like that aspect of it. But it was interesting to see just one of those many crossover book events that they had. But it not only crossed over between the different book series, but also the television series, which was interesting. You guys also joked a little bit about the idea of a Klingon Mother's Day. Well, I find it interesting. In your show, you didn't mention Mother's Day as an actual holiday that appears in Star Trek. You know it does appear in Star Trek, right? Well, it's mentioned. In the Deep Space Nine episode, Who Mourns for Morn, there's all this talk about the Mother's Day heist on one particular planet. I think it's Polaris 9 or... whatever. Some planet. So, there's all this reference to the big Mother's Day heist that happened on this planet. Which just makes you wonder what kind of holiday Mother's Day is on that planet. It's never spoken in canon, but actually in novels we learn that Mother's Day is a religious holiday. And it's the mother, you know, that gave life to all. That kind of mother. Like the Holy Mother. And so, it sort of gives it a different slant when you think of it that way. I don't normally think of that when I think of Mother's Day. But that's where the novel writers went with that idea, that the Mother's Day heist took place on this religious holiday. Still, technically in canon, it's still just Mother's Day. It could be any kind of Mother's Day, including possibly Klingon Mother's Day. Just happened to be on that planet. Data out.
And welcome, everyone, to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
And David is feeling more than a little sick, so he will be providing just engineering because he's down with, I think it was Tarkalian flu, as I recall.
Yeah, that's going around, isn't it?
Or it might have been that Klingon disease that's the equivalent of the measles, but we promise not to tell anybody about that. And, you know, we're going to have that poison tea ceremony later.
If it comes to that, yeah.
And I'm still clearing away the smoke from my console exploding, which is why we're like 15 minutes late to this week. I don't know why, but my normal laptop just decided it was not going to record my voice today. It's tired of my shenanigans.
Is that what happened? I just heard a bunch of screaming on your end and lots of alarms and explosions. I thought you guys were watching Die Hard or something.
Well, not so much watching as happening to us at the moment. For some reason, you know, we can never remember to put circuit breakers in our consoles. So it's
or like little, you know, covers for the console or something. I don't know.
What always gets me is when the console explodes and then like 10 seconds later they're using it again. Like apparently that wasn't actually a problem.
Starfleet control consoles, they take a licking and keep on ticking.
Maybe that's actually the design. Maybe the design is that when there's a power overload, instead of actually damaging the console, it just vents all that energy right in the crewman's face. Because they know that...
Full of energy, great.
Red shirts are more expendable than consoles.
That's very reassuring for the HR department, I'm sure.
No, definitely. And so to comment on Data Logan's voicemail, which you guys just heard...
Uh-huh.
It is kind of lame that the Klingon Honor Day is apparently based on something that Kirk did.
Yeah, just adding more to the human-centricness of the holidays in Star Trek.
But then again, it was kind of lame to start with, in my opinion. Like, when they said, like, a Klingon holiday, I was like, okay, what are they going to do? It's going to be interesting. It's like Honor Day. And it's kind of like, really? Like, you know, Honor Day? It's like having a human holiday called, I don't know, Being Human Day or something. It's... Like,
do we celebrate the show Being Human, or what?
I haven't seen that show yet, but I'd like to.
It would be like, at the risk of sounding self-deprecating, it would be like the Jews having a holiday called Frugality Day.
It's
just taking a quality of your culture and celebrating it just in its singularity.
Well, Well, and it's mainly just that the Klingons are already so honor-centric in later Star Trek. Like, mm-hmm. you start to wonder if there is anything else about their culture that matters to them. Or, you know...
Yeah.
It's
they overplay the honor a little bit.
So that was... you know, I'm not too broken up about Honor Day, especially because that only time it ever came up was in a Voyager episode. Which, you know, so, like, it's not like it
That's
was...
a good episode for B'Elanna, though.
Yeah, it's not a terrible episode. I just, the holiday itself never struck me as being terribly important. And then the other thing that was interesting that he pointed out was about the Mother's Day holiday. Like, and they actually talk about the Sepian Mother's Day heist, which
so we know it is a thing amongst multiple cultures.
Yeah.
But we don't know much more about it other than the fact that it is a day and there was a heist during it. And now Morn has a lot of, you know...
He has a lot of money.
Shady goods, yeah.
Which he keeps at his stomachs. If you recall, I was actually.
Andy is a kick-ass black velvet matador painting.
Because for a long time, I thought that Morn was a Lesepian because they mentioned the Lesepian Mother's Day heist, and they make lots of jokes about Morn's mom. And so I thought maybe they were making some kind of implication that the Lesepians, like the mother, is this all-important figure. But apparently, Morn is not a Lesepian. I think he's a Lurian. So, but that theory was shot out of the water.
Oh, well.
So, I'm actually back now, instead of being back a week early like I was before. So, you know, everyone can enjoy that.
Yeah.
Did you have a good New Year's, Grace?
That's it, Ed. I got to take part in the bid for the Guinness Book of World Records of most people using coconut shells to make horse clomping noises.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
You gotta bag them together, make the...
Yep.
Sound. I can't actually make that sound, but some people...
And we will soon find out whether we met the world record requirements.
Interesting. All right.
Let it never be said that my holidays are boring.
It's true. I had a much more relaxed holiday. I did a lot of work, and I watched the Voyager episode Once Upon a Time. Or as I like to call it, Never Let Neelix Near Your Kids.
Just don't let Neelix do anything.
That's true. I thought it was funny that this was the one episode that they actually had Samantha Wildman in with Naomi Wildman, and this was the episode that they decided that there was going to be an issue about her mom not being there.
Aw.
Like, because, and like, it's all about, like, the premise of the story, it just is basically the Voyager trying to do a TNG story and it not really working for them because they, like, send the Delta Flyer out on some mission and it gets in trouble and has to crash land, and it's sort of like, what was Voyager doing that was so important that it couldn't just go do that itself? Like, why did they send out a shuttle so far away when they're...
Because they needed an A story and a B story, obviously.
That's exactly what it was. And it was just, you know, and it's like, this story would have worked on TNG, because in TNG they were, you know, reasonably close to support, so they could sometimes send shuttles out on odd missions while they went and did the main mission. But Voyager doesn't have a main mission. It's just trying to get home, so I don't...
Its mission is self-preservation.
Yeah, apparently. And of course, you know, this is also the episode where, like, basically Neelix tricks everyone into thinking that he has Naomi's best interest at heart, but really he's just playing through his own issues, and, you know, it's like, no, we can't tell Naomi that her mother might be in trouble, because then she'll worry, and it's like, well, maybe she deserves to know, and... You know.
That's actually one way that I've seen a lot of adults deal with children and try and help them cope with problems, and it's not usually the most effective way, but that's one way parents and adults feel like they need to treat children.
Yeah, and it's
like
a terrible...
Like, kind of shielding them from bad news until the very last minute.
It's a terrible strategy, and it's really only there because it's easier for the parents. It's not a benefit to the children at all, and... You know, sure, I can totally buy that Neelix isn't a good parent. It's just, I don't understand why they let him near Naomi when he's so clearly terrible at it. But that was what I did on my holiday, was I watched a Voyager episode.
Well, the other Trek interest, there's actually a pretty interesting interview in this month's issue of Wired. There's an interview with Ron Moore, which is definitely worth reading, and him talking about the new series he's working on, and... You know, some past stuff about Battlestar Galactica and Star Trek, and it's a fun read. You should look it up and read it if you can.
Now, is it what is this new series that he's working on? Do you know?
Helix.
Helix.
He's working on a new original series about, from what I can tell, a viral outbreak.
I don't suppose he's working on that with Ira Stephen Bear, is he? Because I heard
I honestly don't know. I feel like I should know that, but don't.
Because Ira Steven Behr was also working on a new project, and that sounds familiar, but that could just be me fantasizing.
Who knows? You have a rich fantasy life, Oren. How can we ever tell the difference?
It's true.
Right.
All right, so today, I wanted to start a new little series, sort of like the series we did at the end of the year, where we went through all the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't necessarily do these in order, continuously. Like, next week we're going to have a guest, and the week after that we might do something else. But we'll come back to this every once in a while, where I want to go through every episode of the Zindi arc from Enterprise.
Yay.
Because the Zindi arc, you know, for better or for worse, was a significant change in the way that Enterprise made its stories. And, you know, depending on how you view it, it made the show a lot better, or it, you know, maybe it got too far away from what the show was supposed to be about in the first place. So it's a
from what I can tell, the whole Zindi arc was them trying to make a bid at recapturing audience attention to keep the show from being canceled.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And it's also like Brandon Braga had wanted to do this originally with the Year of Hell over on Voyager, and he hadn't had a chance. So it's, you know,
it's especially interesting that we saw it then when we did with Enterprise, because the writers admitted they took a lot of influence from the events of September 11th,
yeah.
Or at least the start of the story arc.
Well, I mean,
both interesting and at the same time feels a little tasteless to me.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because we're talking about when the probe shows up over Earth,
yeah.
And, like, you know, blasts a hole, mm-hmm. And I don't know, I mean, when I watch that, I don't really get a September 11th feeling, like, any more than any other sudden, unprovoked attack,
mm-hmm.
Right? Unprovoked from the point of view of the people doing the attacking, right? Or,
yeah.
Excuse me, being attacked. You know, I mean, you could just as easily say that it's a reference to Pearl Harbor, or, you know, any other time in which we've been attacked and we weren't expecting it.
Right.
So it's, I don't know, I feel like 9/11 has sort of stolen a part of our cultural identity, where now any time you do any sort of sudden...
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
It's the most recent form of mass attack on the United States that we have, and that's what's at the forefront of the American idea of what terrorism is.
Yeah, I mean... And
that's where a lot of pop culture comes from here in America, so...
I mean, definitely...
That's what we get.
You know, 9/11 certainly shaped our popular culture. There's no denying that. But I mean, if you want a film or a movie that's taking imagery from 9/11, you just go watch Man of Steel. You know, that's a pretty blatant use of it if ever I saw one. Whereas, again, I feel like with this episode, it's kind of like, you know, there was an attack and a bunch of civilians were killed, but 9/11 is hardly the only time that's happened.
All right. But let's get started talking about this episode then in all seriousness. The part that I would actually like to start talking with is the attack itself, that opening scene that we get as kind of a starter bumper where we just see the attack. There's no lead up to it. There's no afterwards. There's just a probe coming out of space shooting into the Earth.
All right.
And it's interesting. It's definitely provoking, but at the same time, this whole section of the episode feels kind of unfortunately sterile with the lack of any build-up or any frame of reference. Just like, show starting, there's an attack, opening music, that's it. It felt very blunt, and it felt like it could have been handled better, I think.
Interesting, because I was actually going to say that I think that's my favorite part of the episode.
Yeah.
So we've got something to discuss already.
Oh, don't we always?
Well, because for me, I liked that feeling because it was like, it left me kind of wondering, wait, what just happened?
Yeah.
Because there's no context given, really. I can just tell that there's a giant space laser shooting at Earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, if I have one complaint with it, it's that the special effect isn't terribly good.
Well, no, the CGI in this entire episode is pretty weird. Like, the point where we see Archer getting kidnapped and we've got the aliens crawling on the ceiling.
Yeah.
I felt like that was yet another instance on this show where just using practical special effects rather than just going straight to CGI could have really helped them and made it look a lot less cartoonish.
No, I agree. The Suliban had that problem all the time, right? Was that the Suliban could do things that were impossible to do with practical effects, and that either the technology or the budget...
They could have tried.
They could have. Frankly, I think they should have just done the Suliban. I think the problem with the Suliban was that they wanted them to do stuff that was beyond their ability.
And to mention, they looked like they were made of aquarium gravel.
Right. And when you think about it, there's not really all that much of an advantage in being able to walk on the ceiling. Like, it's theoretically...
There was an aliens, but that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's theoretically useful, but it's hardly, like, a crushing advantage, right? It'll work once, and then your opponent will start looking up.
It's good for making a dramatic entrance, but that's about it.
Oh, sorry. My mic just fell.
Yeah.
You guys all can enjoy that.
Woohoo!
But I mean, like, you know, just take the Jem'Hadar from Deep Space Nine. It had a much more effective ability that was also much easier to do, right?
Yeah.
So I definitely...
But yeah, I totally agree with you that they should have stuck with at least something that was more doable without looking cartoonish. Because you have to... If you're doing special effects on a show like Star Trek, you need to be aware that there is a camp factor to it, but at the same time, you can just end up looking really stupid. End up with stupid-looking stuff.
I mean, you haven't even seen, I don't think, you haven't seen the one where they go back to World War II, right? Because that's an episode where we get to see the Suliban doing even more of their weird-ass special effects and, you know, Daffy Ducking their way under a door.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
You owe me for this Enterprise junk, man.
Oh, it's going to be great. Don't just you wait. We're off to... we were talking about the opening sequence
yeah.
to The Expanse, which is the name of the episode.
Right.
And so you didn't like it, and I actually kind of did.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a dramatic, but yet not... I didn't feel it was overplayed intro.
It was definitely very attention-grabbing, but at the same time, I felt like without any lead-up or follow-up, it was just like, what just happened? And
yeah.
That kind of frustrated me as a viewer. I don't know if I need instant gratification or what, but...
Yeah, no, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Especially if you... Like, part of it is that I already know what happened, right? So it's hard for me to remember what it was like watching that episode for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, I do have to admit that one part of that isn't as stupid as I've always said. Because I've always complained that this probe was allowed to fly right up to Earth and then, you know, shoot it with a giant laser without anyone trying to stop them.
Yeah.
But I do have to give them credit. The probe did come out of some kind of weird space vortex thing.
It literally came out of nowhere.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to give them a little credit for that. It's still stupid because apparently the Suliban didn't think to install a self-destruct on it. I mean, frankly, skipping ahead, the whole idea of the probe is dumb. Like, because we reveal that they were testing their weapon, but like, why? Like, why did they have to test it on Earth? They have plenty of planets they could just shoot to see if the laser is working.
Because screw Earth, that's why.
Yeah, because apparently they're very good sports about it, and they feel the need to warn Earth that they're coming, you know? Because it would have been so much more effective if they had just rolled up with their complete weapon, like, a year from now, and been like, hi, Earth, and that was, like, the only warning we ever got.
All right. So moving along past that first scene, then we get this scene of Archer telling the bridge crew and Phlox what just happened, and we have this reactionary scene. And to me, it felt like it was supposed to be a very dramatic, very stoic scene, but everyone, aside from Trip, just kind of looks like they don't care. They're like, oh, God, millions of people are dead. That's too bad. And that's kind of a running thing that we get in this episode. I feel like if I were to look at the script or something, there'd probably be Mark saying this line to be delivered very stoically. And where the actors... or the director or whatever is having them act very stoic and trying to have them, you know, putting on a brave face or what have you, the whole thing just comes off as really dispassionate, where we end up seeing only really Trip having an actual reaction. And there's actually a point in that opening scene where they've just announced, we think there's about 3 million casualties so far, and there's a brief cut where we see Hoshi, like, looking dramatic in the background for a sec, and then the very next cut after that, she just looks totally bored.
Yeah.
And I was actually really tempted to make that Photoshop image for the week, just Photoshop Hoshi looking bored with various catastrophic events throughout Star Trek.
Grace,
I was really tempted to do that.
Why did you not do that?
I could do that.
As the captain of this podcast, I charge you to do that. That is your new assignment.
I'll have it on your desk by Monday, Captain.
Excellent. All right. Actually, I'm sorry. I need you to vamp for just a sec. I need to run and take care of something. I will be right back.
Okay. Well, again, it feels like that's a running thing with this episode, and I'm not sure if I've watched enough Enterprise actually to be a good judge of this, but it feels like I can't tell what's wrong, whether it's the directing or the acting itself, but the whole thing feels very dispassionate. Like I was saying, it feels like they were told we need to... They're told there's this horrible catastrophe, and everyone's just kind of like, well, that's a bad thing, rather than people actually being upset. We only really get Trip being upset, and that... what am I trying to say? That really downplays the level of catastrophe, because we established... by the time they get back to Earth, it's established that 7 million people are dead, and this crew is supposed to, you know, be representative of Earth, and, like, other characters would definitely at least have some connection to that part of the world, unless we're still at the point in the future where people in Latin America don't really matter.
Or people in Florida, apparently.
Oh, no, that's the part of what upsets me. The only real reaction we see is to someone who was in Florida, and all these people in Latin America are just kind of seen as casualties. I'm like, that's a little ethnocentric.
Just a little.
Yeah, and, like, it wouldn't have hurt to have other people being like, yeah, I used to have a pen pal in this country, or I used to have friends from school in this country. I mean, we established that Hoshi's been, like, all over the world studying language and stuff. Would it have killed them to be like, yeah, I had friends, I had colleagues down there, and to just make it be that only Trip is the person reacting to this seems very silly, and, like, it really underplays the level of catastrophe that it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. Although I wonder, I don't have the math skills to do this, but I wonder if you ran the numbers, what is the likelihood that Enterprise has, what, like 48 crew members on board?
Yeah.
Something like that. I wonder if you ran the odds, what are the average number of crew members that would have a connection to someone who was killed in this attack?
I guess it'd be at least more than one.
Probably.
Yeah.
At the very
least. To have the one connection be in Florida, again, feels pretty ethnocentric.
Yeah.
I know I'm probably making leaps and bounds there, but that just annoyed me.
I think they don't mention Cuba at all. Like, if you look at that line, it had to go all the way across Cuba.
They just say, from Florida to Venezuela. They don't mention any of the countries in between.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's part of the side effect of having,
it feels like just the general reaction was, it hit Florida! And, you know, some Hispanic countries.
Yeah, some,
but Florida
and some people who weren't white. I mean, that's
part of
the downside, or I mean, one of the downsides is hardly the only one of having a crew that is still like 90% white, even in a supposedly, you know, bright optimistic future where racial like discrimination doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
It starts to make you start to wonder.
It's once you start thinking about that, it really is hard to not to ignore.
Yeah, and especially another thing that I thought was kind of lazy about this episode was that they just sort of they get the message and then they're like, we're heading back to Earth, and then like the next scene they're back at Earth.
Yeah,
and they make some dialogue reference to, oh, it took us 3 months to get back, but like, you know, Enterprise can't go 2 feet without running into something that wants to kill them, and now suddenly we have this 3 months of apparently nothing happened.
Yeah, apparently, just whenever they ran into another alien, they're like, hey, we've got stuff to do, Earth was attacked, we are so busy right now, we can't handle this. They're like, oh, okay, just move right along.
Yeah, just, you know, keep going, you know, nothing to see here. And I think what's odd about it to me is that it wasn't really required for them to go back to Earth. Like, if you look at the plot, they basically didn't have to. Like, they could have just gotten the... Because they get, you know, future guy shows up and tells them what's going on. Really, the only reason they went back to Earth was so that they could be equipped with photonic torpedoes.
Yeah.
That's, like, the only thing that happened that actually needed to happen back at Earth. And
so that T'Pol could start having emotional confliction, such as they are.
Right. Although, again, they didn't actually need to go back to Earth for that, right? Like,
No, they didn't.
Like, what I think should have happened, it would have made way more sense, is if the future guy had given them the info, and then Archer's like, hey, we're actually pretty close to that expanse.
Just move out directly.
Let's go check it out. And then he has the argument with Starfleet, and Vulcan High Command is like, you have to drop off T'Pol first. And T'Pol's like, I don't wanna.
No, I'm suddenly attached to these people, albeit in a very bland way.
Yeah.
Although they also did pick up the Space Marines while they were back at Earth.
Yeah, I guess they had to pick up the Space Marines. There's that. Maybe they had to go
Which
back
to Earth. Which is cool, because the guy from Lost was there, so...
Yeah, to be fair, I do like the Space Marines.
Yeah. We get that brief minute where we have Hoshi talking to them, and apparently she's like the futuristic equivalent of Henry Higgins from My Fair Lady and can like tell where everyone is based on their vocal inflection.
That scene bothered me. It's like Enterprise doesn't know if Hoshi is completely worthless or has an encyclopedic knowledge of every accent on Earth.
Like, which is why I think we need to start just calling her Hoshi Higgins. Can we do that? All those in favor say aye.
I'll vote for that. I'll put my Democratic mandate behind that idea.
Yeah.
No,
another Photoshop idea right there.
Look, Grace, you just keep churning them out. Hit up the Photoshop. But yeah, so I do like the Makos. Like, they're kind of neat, and they the conflict between.
And we see in the next episode that they're like a mixed gender bunch and a mixed race bunch, which is also cool.
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate that they have, you know, not just guys in the Marine Squad, and the conflict between Major Hayes and Malcolm is probably the most legitimate character conflict in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a conflict based on something other than one of them just being a jerk for no reason.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Because, like, they have a legitimate conflict. Like, Reed doesn't appreciate that he's basically been told, your guys aren't enough.
Yeah.
You need other guys who are not part of you and have a completely different command structure and a different objective. And they're sort of, you know, even if they're being polite about it, they think they're better than you.
Yeah. There's a point in, I think, the episode that follows this where they're, like, talking about going to rescue Archer from this sort of space mining camp, and they're talking and they're, like, saying, no, the Marines here, we know the area better, we're going to be better equipped, and what's-his-face McBritish guy is super offended because they're like, oh, they weren't saying they know the area better, they were saying that they're better equipped. It's like, well, isn't that kind of the point of Space Marines? It felt like he was getting kind of over-offended for no real reason that there are Space Marines there.
Well, I don't know. I can't believe I'm defending an Enterprise episode. someone pinched me. I think I might get a nightmare. But, again, I actually liked that part. Because, again, I could see that as, especially since Malcolm comes from a military family and he clearly has issues with his family. Like,
maybe he also has issues with kind of being seen as second stringer to better people.
And he's projecting his issues with his family onto Hayes because Hayes is a military man and his family was a military family.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a legitimate conflict. Now, what I thought was a big disappointment is that when they say that the Makos have, like, special equipment, mm-hmm. it turns out that their special equipment is advanced scope technology.
Yay.
Like, one of them, they have a scope on their
rifle.
They're
able to pick out a Klingon from across the road or something.
You know, they can shoot a guy who's far away. That's their power. And
it's the power of sniper rifles.
And it was like, I understand that, you know, again, the special effects are limited, but that's kind of a problem.
We could have shown them, like, doing some really cool fighting or something, or being very tactical.
Well,
there's still there, yeah.
I did appreciate that one scene where the Lady Mako got, like, attacked, got ambushed, and I was like, oh, of course, they picked the Lady Mako to need help, but then she, like, it turned out she didn't need help, but she busted out her, like, shock baton.
Yeah, and there's a few Lady Makos, and I appreciated that.
It's like, I'm gonna take you down, evil alien, with my shock baton, and, you know, I'm like, okay, that's, you know, by Star Trek standards, that is advanced hand-to-hand combat.
Yay.
Because there was not a single Kirk hammer fist to be seen.
All right, so why don't we get back to the whole T'Pol thing going on with this episode.
Yeah, let's talk about the T'Pol thing.
All right, and they're talking about how they're like, okay, well, you're being sent back to Vulcan, but are you actually attached to this crew and want to keep going with them? And part of me couldn't tell if it was a very cheap idea or kind of a brilliant idea for them to have her, what am I trying to say here? Her feelings, such as they are, expressed by Phlox, being like, oh, I get it. You can't decide whether it's your duty to the High Council or your duty to the crew that you've gotten attached to actually stick with them or go home. And I couldn't tell if that was... I'm still on the fence about whether that was good storytelling or really cheap storytelling right there.
I think it's storytelling that assumes you haven't seen the first two seasons.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if you had, you would kind of know that T'Pol doesn't really like this crew, and they don't really like her.
Yeah.
So there's not really much of a reason for her to stick around, but especially in the face of something so obviously stupid, right?
Yeah, I felt like it was an unnecessary amount of spelling things out, but at the same time, T'Pol isn't going to come out and just say that that's how she feels, so...
Like, to a certain extent, I can understand why she and Phlox would talk about it, because...
You know, yeah, they're the only aliens on the crew.
Right. And also, Phlox, did he seem a little bit condescending to you? He was
definitely, yeah.
For me, it's a matter of loyalty, and it's like, oh, thanks, telling me that I have no loyalty. That's nice.
Well, I think maybe he was trying to probe her and get a reaction out of her.
I'm not comfortable.
Get her to admit what she was thinking, but no.
I'm not comfortable being probed by Phlox in any capacity.
I did not need that mental image, okay?
Well, there you go. It's I'm handing them out today. I did want to mention something. Despite the fact that it is a little bit silly that only Tucker seems to care that there was a giant explosion on Earth, I do appreciate his interactions with Reed.
Yeah.
Because with
Brittany McBritterson?
Yeah, but with Malcolm. With his weird, like, with his whole, like, denial and trying and insisting that, like, his loss...
I don't want your help. I don't need a memorial service. I don't need any of that.
Yeah,
that's the closest thing we really get to see to the rest of the crew reacting is him trying to be sympathetic.
And it's, you know, and Tucker insisting that he doesn't, like, his pain isn't any more special than anyone else's, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, he is totally getting aggro over the whole thing. Just like, I really hope we get to kick the snot out of these guys.
Oh, yeah. No,
and I, there.
Like, this is the part of the show where I start to not hate Tucker.
Yeah.
Because he gets some legitimate development. Like, for the first two seasons, he's just awful.
Yeah. But then when we get a flashback dream sequence later on of him thinking about seeing his sister and imagining him watching her die, we get to see him in a distractingly ugly Hawaiian shirt.
That's just what he wears, okay? Don't judge.
No, it was great, because it's supposed to be this dramatic scene. We see him as a little kid, like, Elizabeth, where are you? And then we see her as an adult, and we cut back to him, and I was laughing, because it just looked so ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it's...
The whole scene just looks really ridiculous, though.
It's not effectively shot. Part of that is because I feel like slow motion is just overplayed.
Yeah.
It's really hard for me to take a slow motion scene seriously. You have to work really hard and have it be a really well-directed shot. And this was just kind of an average shot that they stuck some slow motion on top of.
With really ugly Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah, with really ugly Hawaiian shirts.
And the fact that it's supposed to be dramatic with his sister, like, smiling and giggling while there's a fireball coming towards her. I was laughing.
Maybe she's just an easily distractible person, Grace. We don't know.
She had her oversized beverage and everything.
Look, oversized beverages are an American right, okay? Not even...
Especially for drag queens who want to make their hands look smaller.
Oh, dear.
Maybe that's what he wasn't telling us about, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But really, that's their business.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'm going to move on past that little hot potato.
We could talk about probings, but not about drag queens.
No, it's all about probing with Phlox. I'm just saying.
And weird beetle collections.
Well, that's sort of Phlox's thing. It also, like, this is a relatively minor point, but it really bothered me how easily what's his name Silic with the Sulivan was able to get on board Enterprise and steal Archer and then leave. Because I was like, if he could do that so easily, why has Archer ever been a problem for him in, like, the last two seasons?
What's really strange to me is they have that whole, like, quick thing, like, oh god, where's Archer? And then Archer's on the other ship, and then he just has this conversation, and then he's just back on the Enterprise without addressing, like, how do you get back there? And then, of course, when he's back on the Enterprise, he's, like, telling T'Pol the deal, and she's just instantly down with, okay, so this guy's a guy from the future, right? But time travel isn't a thing. And it's like, wow, you went for that real fast, Paul. No skepticism there?
Yeah, well, remember...
And they even, like, say, like, afterwards, I don't need your skepticism, but she's totally down with the idea that he's from the future.
Well, like, part of the thing that they decided in Enterprise with Vulcans was that logic equals close-minded, right?
Yeah. Also so, bitchy.
Well, yeah, and passive-aggressive, which is just, you know, another reason to not really care for T'Pol, is my opinion.
So many reasons.
So, but by the same token, that's another reason why I have so much trouble with T'Pol's, like, whole I want to stay with Archer thing, is that the way Archer presents his argument is basically, some guy I couldn't really see told me he was from the future, and that he knows that I need to go to this place to stop this thing from happening, and my proof is that this quantum dating is a little weird. And it's kind of like that. It's just...
It's not much to go on.
No, it's just a very weak argument, and, you know, Archer says, hey, what's the, you know, worst thing that can happen is we lose one ship, but, like, Archer doesn't point out that it is... Enterprise is their most powerful ship by a significant margin.
And he's risking the lives of all his crew members on this weird little goose chase of his.
Yeah, and it seems like the more logical course of action would have been to fortify Earth, which I would have appreciated if the Vulcans had, instead of just being down on Archer, being like, no, you can't do your thing because it's too crazy, they had been
That's
like,
kind of the Vulcan's job on Enterprise from what I've seen, to just be like, no, 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 no.
Well, yeah. I wish they had presented an alternate course of action.
Yeah.
Which then Archer could have been like, no, I don't approve, you know, that's a reactionary course of action. We need to seize the initiative, and that could have been legitimate. And so then, like, sort of the climax of the episode is them fighting the Klingons, right?
Yeah, and the whole Klingon sort of B story that we had going on seemed a little unnecessary.
Yeah, well, it's like they had to wrap that up, I think they felt. Like, they had that going through seasons 1 and 2, and they were like, all right, we have to wrap up this sort of dangling plot thread that we left.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we find out in this series that the Duras family is genetically evil. Like, you know, they'll always be bad guys, no matter what point in history you find them in.
I've heard about theories of psychopathic behavior being genetic, but evilness, don't know.
Yeah, it just seems odd. It also bothered me more than a little that with, like, one upgrade that took a couple of weeks, Enterprise could go from getting its butt kicked by Klingons to suddenly now they are the stronger ship.
Yeah, they had a Deus Ex upgrade.
And it's like, that's a huge technology leap for humans. That doesn't seem reasonable.
Well, they had photon torpedoes now, Oren.
Yeah, apparently.
You can also use them as a coffin in a pinch.
Well, yeah, you gotta, you know, shoot your guy onto the Genesis planet. You know, you gotta have something to shoot him at.
And when they were, like, having the scene of them loading up, I was distracted by how coffin-like they looked.
They do really look like coffins. So, you know, it seemed a little odd, and then, like, the actual action sequence is like, it's alright, you know, where they're flying through the cloud, and they do the loop.
Yeah.
And I'm a little confused as to why that's such a difficult maneuver. It's like, I mean, do you want to do an L4? It's like, I don't know if I could do an L4. And it's like, just fly the ship in the loop. It's not that hard.
L4 is the technical term for loop, apparently.
Right, and like in a plane, the reason that loop is considered difficult is because if you're doing it in an aircraft, you have to subject yourself to enormous G-forces.
Right.
In order to do it effectively, but that's not really a problem in space. You just fly the ship in a loop. So, you know, that was a little anticlimactic for me, but whatever, we blew up Duras, we've tied up that story, you know, we're done, we're moving on.
Yeah, it felt like they just kind of were like, yep, Klingons, they're here. Done.
We need to give this action. This episode needs to have an action-packed climax, so we're making it happen.
Because the action-packed beginning wasn't enough.
Nope.
Which is disappointing because they have a level of emotional build-up that they're trying to do throughout the episode. And it's like, why not give it an emotional climax or try and make it more of an internal thing? Because they've been building all this internal tension, but they just decided to go with Klingons.
Gotta fight Klingons. It also just bothers me that the photon torpedo basically just was the final nail in the coffin that this was supposed to be a prequel. Because they basically just have all the same technology that exists in The Next Generation now. Like, it even looks the same.
And yeah.
It's sort of like...
It's pretty futuristic retrofitting.
Yeah, and it's you know, we've complained about this before, but that was one of Enterprise's big failings, is that they were like, this is going to be a prequel set like 200 years in the past, but everything's the same, because
except
we don't...
Except for the jumpsuits.
Yeah, except for the uniforms, which, to their credit, at least have pockets.
Yeah, but I've got issues with the uniforms, but that's a whole nother kettle of fish.
They're certainly very ugly, I'll give them that. I also did really appreciate that we saw that Starfleet has more than one ship.
Yeah.
Like, when the Klingons showed up at Earth, that was probably...
Variety is always nice.
That part was part of my favorite, because it always bothered me that in Enterprise, it seems like Starfleet has one ship, and they sent it off to explore, which it seems like a monumentally irresponsible waste of resources.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, so that's basically the end of that's the end of The Expanse. Okay. So should we talk about Zindi? The episode, because those are the two that that I wanted.
I don't really have anything good to say about.
That's just fine. I remember you mentioning that you wanted to talk about T'Pol's new costume. I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that it really says something about the show that the whole big changeover that they were banking on is like, yeah, we're starting this whole nother arc with that starts out with this terrorist attack, and we're giving T'Pol a makeover. Like, that was their two selling points for continuing the show to the network for at least one more season. And it's like, really? That's what you're going for there? And I will give them this much. It was the actress and her stylist's idea to give her the more Vulcan eyebrows, which really adds something. And they gave her a haircut that made her look less like a little British schoolboy, which is good, because that haircut just was not working out for her. But
yeah.
The new uniform is really what I want to talk about for T'Pol, because it kept distracting me throughout the episode, and I'll admit it's a much less awkward-looking costume than her previous kind of barf-colored jumpsuit.
Ugh, let's never speak of the jumpsuit again.
Yeah, it has the weird shoulder padding and the weird flares at the legs that make it look like she's wearing bell-bottoms, kind of. With her new outfit, it at least looks kind of more uniform-like in the fact that it's got the venting and the piping, which look really good, but the fact that it's made so very slinky is also kind of like, yeah, the Vulcan is still obviously the eye candy here. So while I like parts of it, I think I'd like it a whole lot more if all of her new outfits weren't, pastels.
Pastels.
Because that just adds to the look, like she's just walking around the bridge wearing a leisure suit. And it's really hard to take her. I don't want to say that a woman dresses a way that makes her less easy to take seriously, but the whole time I'm watching it, I keep thinking of how much she's dressed like the cool mom from Mean Girls. Like, well, she's going to offer everyone margaritas and be like, no, I'm hip, check me out, I'm wearing Juicy Couture, bitches.
That's fair. What bothered
me... And then we see her in that ugly-ass crop-top pajama set, but that's...
We'll get to the crop top pajama set, don't worry.
And all of the ugliness that scene entails.
So here's the thing. Here's the thing about T'Pol's new uniform. I basically threw a party when I found out that she wasn't going to be wearing that catsuit thing, which is like a poor imitation of Seven of Nine's costume, which was not a good costume
exactly
to start
what it
with.
Was. But they made it. They were trying to make it look professional, and they just made it look frumpy, and I would have thought it would be impossible to make a frumpy cat suit, but they did it.
So,
a frumpy cat suit that is overfitted at the chest.
Yeah, so they're going to give her a new uniform. I'm like, alright, that's actually logical because she's resigned her commission with, you know, with the Vulcan High Command, so I assumed she would be given a Starfleet commission. Like, that would just make more sense. In fact, I still assume that's what they did, but then they, instead of giving her just a Starfleet uniform, they stick her in this weird red thing. And I'm like, why is she not wearing a uniform like everybody else if she's just part of the crew now? And it's like, well, because we couldn't resist catsuits. We still needed to have a catsuit. It was just a different catsuit.
And while it does look a lot more comfortable than the previous one, also, I don't want to sound like a prude here. It's just way slinkier than what you'd imagine someone wearing in a work environment. It does look like something you'd wear to wear jogging or to your yoga class or something. It doesn't look like something you'd wear for, like, okay, this is a job where I'm going to have to do a lot of running around and getting in on stuff and being serious.
It's not really appropriate.
It doesn't look like civilian wear. That's what I'm trying to say.
It's clearly there because the producers wanted something that they thought would appeal to 18 to 35-year-old men, and not because it makes sense for her to be wearing that within the context of the story, right?
Again, that's kind of what upsets me, that their big selling points for another season was, we're doing this arc, and we're giving T'Pol a makeover.
Yeah.
Like, that the sex appeal of the show was such a big selling point to them, and I think that's part of why I had trouble taking Enterprise seriously the first time around when it was on the air. It seemed like such a stereotypical kind of UPN thing to have going on. Like, yeah, we're Star Trek, but we're new and sexy.
Well, there was that whole thing where for a while they refused to call it Star Trek Enterprise. I don't know if you remember that. For a while it was just advertised as Enterprise. Like, they took the Star Trek.
No, it's Star Trek. Don't fear the Star Trek. Good lord.
And while we're talking about sort of bizarre, out-of-context sex stuff, at least in season three, they dropped the really awkward, like, decontamination sequences.
Yeah.
Now, those were the worst.
Where they rub themselves down with glitter.
Yeah, oh God, those are the worst things that have ever happened to anybody. But at least, so they got rid of those. But they couldn't quite resist still...
Sexy massage scene.
Yeah, still having some pointless sex, so they bring in, like... They do this whole, like, weird Vulcan neuropressure, where Phlox is like, I'm gonna skeezily, you know, sort of pressure you into having...
The crazy thing is how much it looks like Phlox is having fun with that.
Yeah, it's very odd, and then when they finally do the scene, it's shot very... I don't know, like, it's clearly designed to be a sexy sequence.
And we very clearly have T'Pol having, like, a orgasm-like reaction to it. And it's great, because there's a point where he's like, we see Tucker being like, oh, I'm flattered, but I don't think I can be around you that way. And she gets all offended, like, are you thinking this is something sexual? And it's like, well, it's what the show is implying.
It's like, call yes.
A spade a spade, man.
You're taking your top off. And like, I also thought it was funny, this is a minor thing, but I thought it was funny that she decided to hide her breasts from the camera.
Yeah.
Like she knew there was a camera there, and she couldn't let the camera see her nipples. Like, I just thought
also
that was
that,
funny.
That whole scene has a gratuitous amount of side boob. Well, more like behind, side, and under boob.
Yeah, it's...
All of the boob except the nipples, pretty much.
It's just very uncomfortable. Like, I don't... Like, I guess they were trying to start this relationship between T'Pol and Tucker, but there are better ways to do it. And
casual sex a thing for Vulcans? Who knows?
You know, it could be. I'm not a...
It could actually be, but not if it's like this, then it's just creepy. Yeah.
I could actually see Vulcans engaging in casual sex if it would be logical to, you know, to increase that level of their relationship. But that's not what's happening here.
Or for just stress relief or what have you, but this is just really awkward and creepy.
Yeah, it's kind of, like, just...
It feels like T'Pol is kind of, well, kind of literally being pimped out by Phlox.
That, like, is kind of what it feels like. And it's...
Like, they're saying, yeah, Tucker's having emotional problems. Let's get him laid.
Yeah.
T'Pol, you're the resident eye candy. Get your ass in there.
Yeah, and it gets worse later, trust me. It's indicative of one of the unfortunate sides of Star Trek, which is that they've never really been great at handling sex.
Yeah.
Like, Star Trek's take on sex has been that basically, like, a bunch of teenage schoolboys who have just figured out that their calculator will spell boobs.
Yeah.
But
maybe that's why Star Trek is perceived so much as being a less than female-friendly sort of franchise.
Yeah.
Which is sad, because there's an incredible amount of Star Trek fans who are females, but they're still selling it as, like, the teenage boy thing.
Yeah.
Or at least they definitely were with Enterprise.
So there's a lot more of this episode to talk about, but we are at we're at 2 o'clock, and I believe you have to get going.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's fine. I do want to try to stick to an hour format. Well, we got started late, and you know, so that's fine. We will pick this up again when next we return to this topic.
There will be plenty more to whine about, I promise you.
Yeah, we're not even done with this episode. But I hope you guys enjoyed it. David, if we haven't put you to sleep yet and you're still there on engineering, if you'd be so kind as to play us out with a song.